Hello, everybody. Welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ojachowski, and I'll be taking you through the next hour. On today's show, we have an interview that's been a very long time in the making. It was actually pre-recorded last night at 7 p.m., which would be 7 a.m. Time in China, and it's an interview with Jill Robinson. She's the founder and CEO of the Animals Asia Foundation. Before we get to that interview, I was going to do news, but it's a long and interesting interview, and I didn't want to actually distract from it at all. So I'm just going to give you some contact info. If you like what you hear on today's program or any of our past programs, please do get in touch with us. Our email address is animalvoices@gmail.com. If you're on the Facebook, you can always get in touch with us through that as well. We have a group. It's just called Animal Voices. So if you search for that in the little Facebook search box, you will find it. And if you want to check out this show or any of our other shows that we have archived online, I think there's over 240 now, please do check out our website at www.animalvoices.ca. In the next couple weeks, we'll be playing shows with the vegan hip-hop movement and other good stuff coming up, so please do stay tuned. But for now, this is Lauren's interview with Jill Robinson.
Hi, welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Ojachowski, teching for us today. We're doing a pre-recorded show, one that Carl and I have been anticipating for a couple months now. We're really excited to be speaking today with Jill Robinson, and she is the founder and CEO of the Animals Asia Foundation, and we're reaching her today in Chengdu, China. So Jill, a warm welcome to you. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much, Lauren. It's a pleasure.
Let's just kick things off with hearing a little bit more about Animals Asia Foundation, how it got started, how you ended up founding this organization, and what motivated you to create this really fantastic place.
Goodness. Well, I moved into Hong Kong in 1985, and I quickly began working for the International Fund for Animal Welfare for about 11 years. And ironically enough, I walked onto a bear farm, believe it or not, in 1993, and everything really changed from that moment for me, to the extent that I just wanted to devote my time to ending the most odious practice, I think, on this planet, the whole practice of bear farming. And by 1998, I was ready to establish a local organization, which I felt would serve local species in China and indeed across Asia in a much better way, by being able to represent them, as I say, from a local perspective with people in the community that also shared, you know, the same love and respect as I did for animals in this region. And so I started Animals Asia in 1998, and we're celebrating our 10th anniversary, believe it or not, next month, August the 8th, 2008, which, as you probably know too, is the opening day of the Beijing Olympics in China.
When you say you started the organization, I mean, for people who haven't looked at the website, for people who haven't been to either of the sanctuaries or maybe aren't familiar with the various different offices around the world, how does one begin to embark on such a journey as that? Did you go and ask for funds from the International Fund for Animal Welfare? Are you independently wealthy? How did you end up financing this?
You know, yeah, we were very lucky, Lauren, because in the first year, IFOR did provide us with seed money to start, and to some extent, some more in the second year, and after that, you know, from 2000. We were very much on our own, and that's where we are today, being self-sustaining now with the foundation. But of course, very, very grateful to IFOR in those early couple of years.
You mentioned that bear farming for you was sort of the impetus then for creating Animals Asia. Can you walk us through what the bear bile farming industry, what the industry is about, and what you've seen?
Well, it was created in the early 1980s by the Chinese government because previously people had been taking bears from the wild, killing them for their whole gallbladders, where the bile was then used in traditional Chinese medicine. And obviously it was impacting on the wild species. We're talking about a species called Asiatic black bears or moon bears because yellow crescent of a moon on their chest. And it was quickly found, I think, that in fact, just taking the bears and putting them into cages and farming them definitely wasn't saving species in the wild. In fact, it was creating a two-tier demand from consumers. Those of people who were going to the bear farms and buying cheaper bile from bears kept alive in tiny wire cages, and of course people with more money in their pockets were then desiring the whole gallbladders from bears caught and killed in the wild. So it was a well-meaning but very sort of mistaken, I think, action by the Chinese government to start bear farming in the first place. And as I say, it's been going since the early 1980s. Goodness, nearly 30 years on, things are no better for these bears. There are 7,000 incarcerated in cages, so small they can hardly move. They spend literally decades of their lives, very often, in these cages until they die in a cage that will eventually become their coffin. Some of them will die, obviously, much, much sooner than that because of the methods of bile extraction, which will be extraordinary for your listeners, I think. They range from disgusting metal tubes or catheters placed into their abdomens and their gallbladders to latex tubes as well, which come out of the gallbladder, are fed under the skin and exit at the hip area, so that again it keeps the dangerous head end away from where the farmer is trying to extract the bile at the other end. Or now there's a very new method called a free drip fistula, which entails literally a hole which is carved into the bear's gallbladder and abdomen and allows bile to freely drip out. And anyone listening to this with any medical knowledge will know immediately that bile is a horribly invasive acid, and leakage, of course, which happens, will very quickly cause peritonitis. And there's a million other catalogue of injuries that these bears are very often deliberately detoothed. They have their canine teeth cut back to gum level. They have their paw tips cut away to stop their claws ever growing again. They have abscesses and ulcers within their abdomen. They're skeletal. They're usually coming in weighing at least half their body weight only. And, you know, it's a practice that can never, never conform to the five freedoms of animal welfare in any way, shape or form. Because how do you keep essentially a wild animal in a cage with an open fistula in its abdomen and expect that to be classified as humane?
So the different extraction processes that you talked about, I could see some people saying, well, you know, if it's just a drip and it's the tube has already been inserted, and if it's not being moved around, you know, maybe they don't experience that much pain. Maybe it's just as simple as like almost like milking an animal that wants to be milked.
But even that sort of process, Lauren, you would only be called back your access surgery, and you would be doing that under very tight sterile conditions in a laboratory. You just wouldn't let an animal walk around with a hole in its abdomen. You know, a tube going in still has access for, you know, bacterial infection. Of course it does. And this is exactly what we're seeing on the farms. We have never, never seen, and I mean, we've rescued now over 250 bears. And in, you know, 99% of cases, we're seeing massive infection in their bodies, massive compromises from these methods of bile extraction. And these so-called, you know, free drip holes now are just leaking blood and bile and pus. And again, causing extraordinary pathology. You know, the majority of bears, for example, when they die, both on the farms and with us, are dying of liver cancer. And the percentages now, again, as I say, are extraordinary. Too much so to be a coincidence, and we're now analysing the liver tumours with Chinese pathologists. Some of these tumours are weighing 7 kilograms in weight, and we now believe that there's a tumour factor between the pus-infected bile and the cancers that are killing these bears. And if they're killing the bears, what on earth are they doing to the people consuming this fluid? So again, no, I don't believe. I think if any of your listeners, again, are medically qualified, I think they would concur too that you cannot do this in a humane method to a wild species.
Has there been any attempt to speak directly to the farmers? I was reading on the Animals Asia website about the hope and also the incentive for people to move out of bear bile farming into other industries. Can you comment on any dialogue that happens between Animals Asia or other organization and people who are clearly feel that this is either necessary economically or for medicinal reasons?
Well, we've been working on this, obviously, I mean, as I say, since 93, since I first walked onto a bear farm, and very intensively since 2000 when we started our sanctuary here in Chengdu. And Animals Asia have been talking with bear farmers, with stakeholders in the industry, the government themselves. We have government partners now, which we have had for the last 8 years as well. And one of the crucial elements in this, obviously, with, you know, many farmers now are impoverished. In certain cases, there are a lot of small farms still dotted around, but there are also these super farms with much, much richer farmers. But the smaller farmers, for sure, you know, are not making too much money in this industry anymore. So we worked with the Chinese government on a campaign which would allow the farmers to close down their farms and in return receive compensation from Animals Asia. Then we would receive the original license, and the farmer would not be allowed to farm bears again. China has not issued licenses since 1994, so they would have to completely move out of the industry and go into something else. And because of that agreement, we've closed now over 40 farms in the country of China. And obviously, we'll continue with that policy to compensate people whose livelihoods would really be badly affected if we didn't. It's as simple as that. And working right here, right now in China, we can't afford to fall out with the local community, with the government. We have to recognise that people's livelihoods are affected as a result of our work, and we have to sort out how to deal with that by providing compensation.
Hmm. How have you responded, or have you found that people have responded to you openly, or is there a sense that you in particular, being seen as a Western woman coming in and telling people what to do in their country, and perhaps being seen as kind of an invasive presence there and none of your business, how do you respond to that?
I think the farmers certainly feel like that, but of course, again, as I say, the richer ones are very protective of their industry. But no, I mean, I've been living out here a long time. You know, I moved out in 1985. And quickly established a lot of Chinese friends and understood, you know, that one has to work in a particular way here. And I think to some extent, being a woman and a softly spoken woman at that, you know, was an advantage in the early days. I really wasn't seen as a threat at all. And I was able to sort of build up trust with the Chinese government in those early years, with Chinese medicine doctors as well, with whom we formed a very close partnership. And it was, you know, I think over the years, as that trust was growing, suddenly it was an acknowledgement from these people that, oh my God, this really is not only harming the bears and impacting on their welfare, but yes, there could be something in what you say about impacting the health and welfare of the people that consume bile. And we're at that stage now, you know, where we have a lot of support here. For a start, our team here in China at the sanctuary, we employ over 150 people. And 90% of those are Chinese. Obviously, we have to have, you know, for 250 bears, we have to have people skilled in bear management, in horticulture, in the day-to-day administration of the sanctuary, of security, for example, and education, PR campaigns. And these are all Chinese people just working equally as passionately as any one of your listeners, you know, if they were in the same situation. And that, I believe, is what is going to end bear farming. You're absolutely right, not some Westerner pointing this finger, this imperialistic finger, I might add, you know, and demanding that bear farming ends. Absolutely not. It's the voice of the Chinese people here, and that is what is developing now. And I'm very, very proud to be part of this movement.
I was wondering if you could comment further on the cultural attitudes about animals in Asia. In particular, there's a stereotype about China being a bad place for animals, and of course it's tied in particular with ideas about dog and cat eating, and then how that gets taken up in a Western context. And I thought it was interesting when we interviewed a group from Korea a while ago, and this is the same language that was used on the Animal Asia's website about the desire to restore a particular cultural perspective to animals that is caring. But how do people think about animals in the places that you've been, and is it changing?
Well, I'm very saddened, particularly. I do a lot of road shows around the world, and I'm saddened to hear, you know, rather sweeping statements, I think, about the Chinese and, you know, references to, oh, they don't care about animals like we do in the West. And it's completely untrue. You know, I think, certainly in China, perhaps, people born in my generation that have lived through things like the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution were poverty, you know, and death was just ravishing across the country, you know, where it would again be so inappropriate to be talking about a love of animals, for example. But today the movement is gradually changing. You know, you've got green groups cropping up in almost every single university across the country. You've got government officials for the first time talking about animal welfare, which was never spoken about before. And you've got a real sort of sense of commitment now to the environment, to conservation, to welfare. And again, it's a storming movement now that people are finding their voice. And that, in a sense, is the role of Animals Asia, to give people the tools to use that voice. You know, your listeners won't believe this, but we actually have, in many, many cities now across the country, demonstrations. Now, of course, we shouldn't say demonstrations. We would maybe use a gentler word like public exhibitions. Mm. But they're locking themselves in cages to protest about their consumption of dogs and cats, for example, and about the cruelty in the bear farming industry. And they're really making their voices heard. It's an amazing time now to be in China. And again, I'm very, very proud of that.
Can you take us back to the bear biofarms for a minute, and the rescues in particular? I always try to personalize the it's very easy to talk about these numbers. You mentioned 7,000 bears still suffering, and of course you've had the opportunity, and as have the people that involved the organization, to help a great many of them, at least some. Could you tell us about some of the bears that you have met or your staff has met, and some of the rescue stories?
Goodness. I don't know where to start. As I say, we've rescued 247 in China and 14 in Vietnam. And we now have the sanctuary today, which has about 180 bears living with us on site. They are an incredible species, Lauren. They're highly intelligent, highly endangered, and obviously highly forgiving as well. I mean, these are animals that arrive with us, absolute shells of their former selves. We received just a couple of months ago, for example, another group of 28 bears, and literally all of them were at death's door. They were coming in weighing something like 65 kilos when a healthy adult bear would be weighing 165. They were missing paws from being caught in leg hole traps. One was dead on arrival. We lost 11 bears in the first 10 days as a result of their injuries and their wounds, and predominantly liver cancer as well, for which they were sadly euthanized. But the remaining 17, that we just lost one a couple of weeks ago as well, but we've got 16 now that are still alive, and at last, thank goodness, doing incredibly well. But even they, you know, are nothing like the bears that are now finally in our bamboo forest enclosures here in Chengdu. An absolutely phenomenal species. They're sort of bursting out of their dens every morning and afternoon like 10-year-old children. They're enjoying a life that they never had before. As I say, remember, 20 or 30 years incarcerated in tiny wire cages, painfully milked with their bile, and now they have what they never had before. They have the choice. So they can integrate with friends. They're not a social species in the wild. They're very solitary, but we have amazing enrichment programs here, amazing bear managers that run those enrichment programs, which keep these animals busy and happy and stimulated 24 hours of the day, which prevents sort of dominant behavior and encouraging foraging, which obviously is what they would be doing in the wild. So the management reads like an encyclopedia, if you like, but it works very, very well. And we've got bears like Jasper that was trapped in a crush cage for 15 years. He was flattened to the bars of his cage for all of those years, and we now call him the peacemaker because he just, you know, runs around his enclosure playing with all the other bears as he has for the past 8 years, welcoming new bears into that same group, loving, you know, bears and people alike, and a million other bears with similar stories to tell. It's someone came to the sanctuary a while ago and just said, "This is food for the soul, and I can't put it any other way. I can never explain how beautiful it is. It's built on 25 acres. There's 10 enclosures, which also deal with our disabled bears. We have two whole enclosures full of animals missing limbs, eyes, teeth, you name it, which again is no impediment to the sheer joy that they have today."
Can you give us a sense of what a rescue looks like? Where are the bears coming from? And then how does Animals Asia intervene in a situation?
We tell the Chinese government you know, that we've built a certain amount of new enclosures, how many bears that we're prepared to take in. And they will look at the list of farms they have in basically the Sichuan region where we're based, and close the appropriate number of farms to match the number of bears that we can take on, accommodate. It takes a while to do this, but ultimately then the trucks start rolling into our sanctuary, and we bring them in first into a quarantine area where we hold them in quarantine for several months, and assess their injuries. Basically, they're going to need an emergency health check so that we could just get them out of those crush cages, have a look at the entire impact to their body, if you like, even look at their mental health as well, because, you know, where some of the bears may not be so badly affected physically, if they have mental problems too, again, it's inherent on us to be able to deal with that situation as well, because, you know, they do start to self-mutilate and badly stereotype, as they do in zoos, for example, when they're kept under such dire conditions. So we need to sort of start dealing with all mental and physical impacts to their bodies as soon as possible. We start rehydrating them, we start medicating them, and preparing them for major abdominal surgery. Every single bear needs the gallbladder removed, because we find again that they're so badly damaged from these awful surgeries. I hesitate to say surgery, I'd rather say butchery on the farm, where these crude catheters are inserted or these holes are carved into their abdomens. And again, to tidy up the other problems, 90% of the bears, for example, need dentals. If the bear farmers haven't chopped their teeth back, then the bears will have done the job themselves by perpetually biting on the bars and just shattering their own teeth as well. And so they need the teeth either being removed or repaired. And, you know, other things we find when we go in, some of the catheters have slipped back into their abdomen. We've found old swabs that have been left behind from the original surgery on the farm, even toothpicks, believe it or not. And all of them will have abscesses, ulcers, and pus-infected bile. Even the sutures, you know, again, doctors and nurses listening to this will be horrified when, you know, we go in and we see the internal stitches are not absorbable, and they're like shoelaces almost, and they've caused, again, massive abscessation within the abdomen. Whole gallstones, huge great gallstones in the gallbladders as well. Anyone that's had a rice-sized gallstone will know how painful that is, and we're getting them the size of my fist. And how does any animal live through this? We keep saying that, you know, dogs, cats, ourselves could not sustain this level of pain, but bears are so stoic. They seem to be able to sort of last longer than any other mammal would in this sort of situation, and I guess that sadly is why they're used on the bear farm.
I wanted to follow up about the emotional and psychological impacts of bear bile farming, because, of course, there's all sorts of terrible physical things that happen, but we very often miss the psychological impacts, especially because if you're not around these bears very much, you could think, well, maybe it's just a matter of sort of sewing them back up again and giving them some antibiotics, and then they're on their way. Can you tell us, Jill, a bit more about the types of emotional or psychological states that these bears arrive in when you do rescue them?
Oh, with pleasure, Lauren. I mean, it couldn't be more profound. You know, bears, again, as I said, are highly intelligent animals, and I really sort of wonder how we would be after 20, 25 years in a cage, you know, and they are. I mean, they're cage crazy. They're out of their heads with stress. They're violently stereotypic. Many of them are missing the fur from their heads. We've got one bear called Quantock who came in not only missing the fur from perpetual bar rubbing during his time on the farm, but also he was missing the skin on his head, and also, believe it or not, the end of his nose cartilage. Such was his distress, you know, and we're getting so many bears in horrible situations that rubbing their ears, for example, right down to the skull level as well. They're coming in with only half their ears, for example, of course their ears. And we have to do an enormous amount of work to sort of steer that mental degradation away from such suffering now to, you know, to a sense that nothing bad is ever going to happen to them again. Our enrichment programs are to the extent that over a 10-day period, 20 different rotations of enrichment are put out there in the sanctuary, again, to keep them very busy and active. This involves not just food, changing the types of food that they're getting. They get a sort of a basic areas. So when they come out of those dens, they can't anticipate anything at all. And obviously some of this, in the early days when they first come in, has to be backed up by drugs. You know, we have to use drugs as well, because there's just some things you cannot do on your own. We've been very, very lucky, you know. We've lost one bear in China and one bear in Vietnam, who've just bitten down to their bones in self-mutilation. There was absolutely nothing that we could do for them, and it broke our hearts when we had to euthanize them. But, you know, out of sort of over, goodness, now 260 bears, that's not bad going to have lost two when you recognize the sheer awful mental condition that they arrive in.
Why do they do those stereotypic behaviors in the self-mutilation? Do we have a psychological understanding of the bears? Is it similar to people? Is it about stimulation or distraction? What's happening there?
Well, I'm afraid, you know, if anyone goes sort of many zoos around the world, anywhere, you know, you will see when an animal is kept in an inappropriate environment, when they have barren concrete enclosures with nothing to stimulate their intelligent minds, they will revert into this stereotypic behavior. And bears, you know, top of the tree on this, together with elephants and large cats as well. You know, it's very, very difficult to manage bears under captive situations. And again, it's even worse on the bear farms, where literally they are in a cage the size and shape of their own body. That is it. They can't move around. They can't stretch. They lay there just rocking backwards and forwards for decades. And so you can imagine the shells of animals that we receive as a result of that, you know, after years and years. So it's a huge challenge, you know, and we have bears that we can't integrate in groups because they just don't want to do that. You know, they have been so badly affected. We've got special care areas. We've got a brain damaged bear here called Rupert. He's absolutely beautiful, but we can't put him in an enclosure with other bears, you know. So we have to obviously, you know, assess the condition of each and every one. They have different personalities and characteristics as we do, and we need to, you know, find management programs to accord to that.
You mentioned the area too, I'm not sure in which sanctuary, maybe it's both the Vietnam and Chinese sanctuary, where there's a place for bears with physical disabilities. You mentioned animals that had, bears that had lost arms or eyes. How are they sustaining those injuries? What's happening to
them?
Well,
again, I'm just in awe of this species. And I think, again, people with disabled dogs and cats would really empathize with this. They just get on with their lives, and bears are no different. We have completely blind bears now that we're experimenting out in enclosures with sighted bears with electric sensing, and they are sensing the pulses on the fencing and recognizing that they should not go near that, and they're integrating beautifully well with the others. The bears with three limbs, well, forget it, you would never know. We had the best of times the other day, you know, all of us going up to what we call house six, where we saw three-legged bears just shinning up trees that they shouldn't be, that actually were protected, believe it or not, by electric fencing, because we're trying to protect some of our endangered trees. And they had worked, these disabled bears had not only worked out the electric fencing around the trees, but they also worked out how to shin up, you know, vertical trees, almost with no branches at the bottom. And they were having a whale of a time, just stripping the trees bare, throwing the branches down to their friends below. And, you know, it just, we just thought, well, goodness, I think we've done something right. You know, if these bears are enjoying their life out to the extent where they're circumventing all regulations and just getting on with their lives.
So, but in terms of the bear bile farms themselves, why would they be, I mean, they must be arriving once you're rescuing them with these missing limbs, for example. Why would they have a missing leg or a missing arm? What's happening in the farms themselves that's creating those types of injuries?
Well, they've been caught in the wild, Lauren. They're illegally trapped. You know, this has been an illegal thing to do since 1989. So theoretically, those animals would be, what, you know, over 18, 19 years of age now. But they're not. They're coming into us at 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age, still missing their limbs from being illegally caught in the wild in leg hole traps or snares. We are pointing this out directly to the government, you know, and saying you cannot, you know, organize this industry to the extent that you're on top of it. You know, your regulations about bringing them in from the wild are not working. Your regulations on the farms about cages no longer being legal, about all the old methods of bile extraction, like tubes and catheters, are no longer legal, but still we are finding they're compromised by these methods time and time and time again. And again, at the end of the day, when we find bears that do accord to the new regulations, still we find them at death's door, dying of liver cancer and compromising what we believe is the health and safety of people consuming this bile. This is an unnecessary industry. Bear bile has been used for thousands of years in Chinese medicine. It does work. Please don't anyone disparage the use of bear bile, because it has even been analysed from people like Minnesota University, who have said to us, you don't know what you're dealing with here. This is amazing stuff. It contains ursodeoxycholic acid. It can be used to rejuvenate cells in your brain that would otherwise die, like Huntington's, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. But Chinese and Western doctors agree it can easily and cheaply be replaced, and no one is going to die for the lack of bear bile. So let's not lose sight of this. And, you know, we need to appeal to the Chinese government. Recognize that this is an endangered species. Recognize that bear bile can be replaced, and give these bears their time again. You know, the farmers have had their day. Let the bears have theirs.
What are some of those replacements then? Because, of course, as you're kind of pointing to already, people are going to say, well, this is just such amazing stuff. And, you know, when it comes to people's health over animals' health, we're going to put people's health first. And these other things can't do nearly the job that the bear bile would do.
Exactly. But, you know, Lauren, I tell you, it may be amazing stuff, but when it comes in from the belly of a farmed bear, it's black sludge. You know, bile should be a healthy sort of greeny, yellowy colour. This is black sludge, full of infection, and as I say again, causing, we think, the liver tumours in these bears. And again, it's unconscionable when we recognise there are 54 different herbal alternatives and synthetic alternatives that can be created in a laboratory for pennies without a bear. 100 tonnes of it, of synthetic UDCA, is already being sold now across Korea, China and Japan, and tonnes of it are being sold in the West. If you've got gallstones, if you've got liver problems, if you've got cholecystitis, for example, you will already be taking probably synthetic UDCA in boxes, and that is not bear bile, but it's something that's been synthesized in a laboratory without the use of bears.
I think we'll probably shift the conversation to the Animals Asia rescue efforts with the earthquake that happened in Sichuan, but I wanted to make sure that as we leave the topic of bear bile farming, and of course because it's the foundational issue of Animals Asia, if there was anything else that you wanted to say, or if there's a way that people can get involved.
Absolutely. I'll give you the phone number at the end of the program, but there's so much that people everywhere can do. We are really calling on now people to help us end this industry of bear farming. I believe with more voices, you know, writing to the Chinese embassies politely. Again, we can link it with the Olympic Games in a good way, because it's called the Green Olympic Games. And of course, what does the word green have to do with 7,000 endangered black bears rotting away on farms? I think, again, with so many Chinese people on side, with an ear to the Chinese government, we're closer than ever, and we just need the support of people in the US and everywhere else across the world to, you know, make the case for the bears and allow us at Animals Asia to help close these farms. We will help work with the Chinese government. We will rescue as many of the bears that we can. We will work in situ on the farms, provide funding for compensation, do everything we can to stop people losing their livelihoods, but at the same time end a horrific industry that should never have begun.
It's a very compelling argument, Jill. Is there other organizations that are working on bear bile farming?
There's no other organization that are actually physically rescuing bears in the field like us. You know, there's other groups doing different pockets of projects. For example, IFOR for a long time have been doing a lot of research in the field of the bear bile industry. The World Society for the Protection of Animals have been doing work in Vietnam, for example. In fact, they microchipped 4,000 bears a couple of years ago, and now any unmicrochipped bear is ostensibly an illegal bear and should be coming to the Animals Asia Sanctuary, where we have it based in Tam Dao National Park in Hanoi. So there's a lot of groups, for example, in Vietnam, ENV, who are doing amazing education work now within the country to the people, you know, getting local people on board now against the industry. So yes, you know, I think, again, it's with more and more groups and people out there in the community across the world, we definitely are stepping closer to ending it all in Asia.
I wanted to talk about the rescue efforts for animals affected by the recent earthquake in Sichuan. And I really liked the little anecdote that was provided on the Animals Asia website about how people within the organization needed to draw straws to decide who would be allowed to go, because it sounded like everybody wanted to go and be involved and to help out. Can you tell us about what happened with the earthquake? This was right around the time when we were trying to get you on the show, and it was just sounded like you were just mad busy. So can you tell us about what happened with the earthquake and how Animals Asia was involved?
Goodness me, Lauren, I don't know where to start. It was a time of absolute chaos. You know, as we know, an earthquake of, goodness, what was it, nearly 8 on the Richter scale hit Chengdu on the 4th of May, and 90,000 people to date have lost their lives in this awful disaster. We on site weren't too badly affected in relation to our people and our bears, who were all safe, but 5 of our buildings were very badly damaged and will need to be completely rebuilt. But as you said, within a day or so, it was very obvious that the staff wanted to help and wanted to get out into the field working with people like the Chinese Red Cross. We got in touch with them, and the first trip that they allowed us to do was to go up into the Dujiangyang, which is an area, one of the worst affected areas, and we went in there. Obviously, we've got qualified vet staff that can bandage people as well as they can bandage animals and deal with broken bones and things. And we went in there with our vet staff and a lot of medical supplies. And we realised as soon as we got there that things were in such chaos at that time that, we, you know, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people, qualified people in China, flooding into these areas, also wanting to help. And we knew that, you know, that in a sense, we all almost could be detrimental to that health effort. When they're just trying to sort themselves out. So we actually left our medical supplies and said, when you know where you want to send certain teams and you know what to do, call us and we'll come straight back. Within a couple of days, they did call us, and we were finding ourselves walking up into a mountainous area called Anxian, where, again, a lot of damage had occurred. A lot of people lost their lives. And we were able to bring medical supplies way up into the mountain where the villages were cut off at the top, leave our supplies halfway up so that the army could then carry on taking them up there. And also we were able to work on the ground where the people were actually coming down from the villages and helping the Red Cross there with people that had obviously been injured and needed help. We were able to offload the trucks, for example, that were coming in with supplies, medical supplies, water, food for people in the shattered village areas. And finally, we were then called by the government, where we were allowed to work to help animals. And that was a great relief to us as well, because we've been hearing, obviously, for several days that obviously people's dogs and cats were very, very badly compromised. The houses had been destroyed. People were now living in tented areas where dogs and cats were not allowed. And the government were announcing culls, killing everywhere of people's own pets in these tented areas. We tried to appeal to them. We said, you know, dogs are your front line in disasters. They're actually stopping disease by keeping rodents away, for example. They're finding people buried in the rubble, survivors. They're finding people that have lost their lives, again, preventing disease. And last and definitely not least, they're providing compassion and comfort for those families that have literally lost everything. But I'm afraid the government wouldn't listen, because they said that people in adjacent tents were still complaining about the noise, about the fecal pollution, and about the risk of disease. So there was nothing else that we could do except go in there and put notices next to the government notices saying, we will help you. Tell us where your dogs are. Bring your dogs to a rescue station that we set up. And they did, you know. But we today have got over 130 dogs that we've taken in from the disaster areas, people's pets, where we will now keep them for, you know, however long it takes for people to rebuild their homes and rebuild their lives. We've got cats as well, and it gives people that comfort now to know that even though they can't take their animals with them, they're not going to be brutally killed. They're going to be safe and sound with us until the time they're ready to take them back.
Can you tell us again some of the stories or some of the reports and some of the things that you saw during the rescue when you were finally able to get to some of the animals?
Right. Well, there were aftershocks going on all the time, and there was one unforgettable day when we were working in an area which was very badly affected, and it was an area of pet shops in this sort of small square, and we'd heard the frantic barking of these animals that were behind shutters that had been there for several days. We got the local authorities, bless their hearts, they couldn't have done more to help us, to go in, and finally they managed to find the pet shop owner and open the doors, and you just wouldn't believe it, the stench, the barking of about 40 animals that were stacked in cages on top of each other, the urine and the feces were just pouring through to the animals below. They were dehydrated, they were skinny, starving, desperately in need of water. And that was the longest half hour of my life. We were just running in there, grabbing the cages and running out again, dealing with them in the square, rehydrating them, providing them food, which they were just bolting down. They were so hungry. And all the while, you know, we were getting pieces of rubble falling off the buildings around us. And at one point, an air conditioner fell off high up one of the buildings. And we managed to get these 40 dogs out of the square. And you know, the good news is, well, I guess it's good news. These dogs are all 8 or 10 years of age. They were all breeding machines, believe it or not. And they were so old that the pet shop owner told us he didn't want them back. Mm. And in many ways, that made us feel pleased, because they would have just gone back to be breeding machines in cages. So we were able to get them out. We can get them into enclosures and run at a rescue centre that we're funding, and hopefully adopt them out into loving families here in China, mm. Who would like them. So that was just one of the story. We had another story of a dog called Tudo, which means potato in Chinese, and he'd been running around at his owner's home the morning of May the 12th, barking and snapping at his ankles, and the guy went sort of out into the street to see what the fuss was all about, and at that very second, the earthquake hit, and his house came down. And he said, this elderly man, he said, Tudo saved my life. And, oh. You know, stories like that just you know, what it's all about, really. You know, and the community, too. We went into the refugee camps where we were given dogs by people whose houses were, you know, dotted around, where they said they were risking their lives going back into these collapsed houses to feed their dogs because they weren't allowed to keep them in the refugee camps. Again, old ladies, old men, just crying and crying that the thought that they were so frightened to go back into these places, but they wanted to keep their animals alive, and then just huge relief being able to hand them over in our care until they could have them back. And again, no one was saying to us, no one, you know, how can you be helping the animals and not people? Mm. It was the opposite. They were just saying, thank you for helping the animals, when people like the Red Cross are helping people. You know, it's nice to know that someone's helping the animal community too.
Were there other animals besides people's companion animals that were around, animals that had been part of farms or other animals?
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of domestic agriculture farms around that have been badly affected. I think the pig population was really badly affected, and I know that the Hong Kong SPCA had come in and were looking at that situation as well. And this was, I mean, you know, again, Animals Asia were dealing with drowning actually in dogs and cats, and just trying to deal with that side of the problem. You know, there's not enough hours in the day, there's not enough people to help, you know, to go in and help the agricultural animals. But again, the SPCA are there doing that. But it's a disaster everywhere. You know, it really is. It's not over yet. People are still picking up their lives. We're still going into these tented areas. We're still getting dogs coming in. And it's going to be like this for the next few months, if not years. You know, it's hard to comprehend when you see these whole towns, whole cities razed to the ground. Nothing left. You know, and you just think, how are these people ever, ever going to rebuild their lives? It's just so, so sad.
In terms of where the animals go, was there situations where you weren't able to take all the animals due to capacity issues, or just weren't able to help animals on site for whatever reason, or was Animals Asia really able to be there each and every time where an animal needed help, in terms of when the staff or you saw an animal that was in need?
Yeah, so far we have, Lauren. We've been very lucky. We've found a fantastic rescue centre just about an hour or so drive away called Qimeng, and we're funding them now with the help of HSI. Have given us very, very kindly given us a donor. and Gil Michaels and his group have given us a donation to build proper enclosures for the extra dogs that they're caring for now. So we're bringing in the dogs and providing medication. People like Pedigree have been providing the food. We've been having vaccinations donated to us. So everybody has been pulling together to help in this situation, and we've been able to deal with the capacity of animals we've received so far. But you're absolutely right. There will come a time when we have to say we cannot take any dogs or cats anymore in, and that's going to be heartbreaking. But, you know, if we don't say no, you know, we're going to be very quickly seeing an animal welfare situation as a result of that, you know, as a result of overcrowding, for example. We still have some room here where we are at the Bear Rescue Centre. We've got temporary enclosures set up for dogs and cats that are sick and can't go to the rescue centre. So we're dealing with it as best as we can. But again, you know, please let's not forget, this is a disaster situation. We just have to take each day as it comes. Mm.
We only have a few more minutes left, and I was wondering if you had any last things that you wanted to share, or any comments about your work at all, or again, what people can do in terms of getting involved. If there's a way that people can get involved, we talked before about bear bile farming, but maybe there's things that people can do to help out with the relief efforts to help animals that have been affected by the earthquake.
Yes, please. I mean, we've put out an earthquake appeal because, again, we're just drowning in work now, and obviously we never anticipated that something like this would eat into our funds. So we're desperate for funds, of course we are, to help not only the dogs but also to rebuild some of the buildings that we've lost here on site at the Bear Sanctuary. And yes, please, anyone can get in touch with our US office, with our lovely US director, Alice Ung, there. And the number is very easy. It's 1-888-420-BEAR, B-E-A-R, 1-888-420-BEAR. Or, of course, our website, www.animalsasia.org. There's a host of ways that people can write. Even if you can't spare a few dollars, please take the time to write letters to the Chinese Embassy to appeal to end bear farming. We have sample letters up on our website, again, that people can take that. Again, remember, please, please do not rant and rave at the Chinese government. They won't listen to this, but they are listening to gentle persuasion. You know, we are seeing amazing progress as a result of our work right here, right now in China. You know, we know the approach, and it's definitely with the use of sugar rather than salt. An old saying that she's there. Please be polite, be respectful. We're seeing mountains move as a result of that sort of appeal.
Just as we go out, I was interested in hearing a bit of a retrospective for you about some of the major things that you've learned over the years being involved founding Animals Asia Foundation. So any words of wisdom that you might have for activists that are currently in the field doing work, or those that hope to start up an organization themselves?
Oh, goodness. Well, I have my friend and mentor. It's a woman called Virginia McKenna, who began the Born Free Foundation. In fact, she was the original actress in the film Born Free way back when I was 6, and I fell in love with her at that point, and we became friends. And when I first wanted to set up Animals Asia but was really in a state of flux about whether to do that, I called her and, you know, and said, Ginny, what should I do? And she said, the worst thing you can do, Jill, is wake up an old lady regretting you never tried. And that was that. I thought, she's absolutely right. I want to do this. I remembered the words of my father, hit it hard, and I hit it hard. And but, you know, we're here with Animals Asia, with 150 staff working for us, with over 250 bears rescued, with a myriad of programs to help dogs and cats, and I think and I hope we're making a difference.
Well, Jill, it's really inspiring to talk with you. Thank you so much for the work that you've done over the years, and congratulations on your upcoming 10-year anniversary.
Thank you, Laura, for the opportunity. It's so kind of you.
It's really it really is inspiring for us, and I have personally been moved by the stuff that I've read and, of course, listening to you today, and I really urge people listening to get involved and to support this really fantastic foundation. Thank you so much, Jill Robinson.
Thank you, Laura, very much indeed.
Thanks, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day in Chengdu.
Thank you, and a good night to you.
Thanks so much, Jill. Take care.
Take care, and to Carol. Thank you very much for the technical side.
Thanks for your time. I know you're very busy.
No, it was a real pleasure. It was lovely to talk with you, Lauren. Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye for now.
Bye for now. Take care.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have any questions or comments for us, please do write us. We'd love to hear from you at animalvoices@gmail.com. And of course, we have a fancy Facebook group and would love to meet and greet you there. And you can just type in Animal Voices if you're a Facebook member. It's really easy to become one and find us there. And you'll get information about upcoming shows and notification when these programs, these live shows or pre-recorded shows as we did today, will be archived on our website again, as are 240 plus programs at this point that you can download for free. Thanks so much to Carl for doing the teching for us. This pre-recorded show is a little while in the making. I'm really pleased that it actually did happen. And, of course, stay tuned. Dos Mundos coming up with Sergio next.